Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Pleasant good morning to you. This is Patrick Timpone. We're live here from Dripping Spring. Can you believe it? I don't know. Can't even make it up. Going into our 11th year on this show from the Palatial Studios in Dripping Springs, Texas. OneRadioNetwork.com. Patrick Timpone. Next hour, Dr. Jane Orient's going to be here. She's an interesting doc that's been studying the history of epidemics, and it's really curious. Around this time of the year, they start talking about different epidemics, and saw one yesterday about some cell-eating epidemic that's never been seen. I mean, they come out with all these things, and she has some interesting idea of who's behind this stuff and why, and it'll be a little fun to talk to her about that, why not? And in first hour, we are going to get younger, stronger by moving our body. As you know, I'm doing an experiment this lifetime. Truly am. I mean, it's to see how long I keep the body. Because I kind of believe we can keep it as long as we want. I know that's a little extreme, but a lot that goes into that. Spiritual stuff and your karma and your dharma and your fate. And of course, my theory has been that what we think and believe and all that is 98% of it, and the rest of it, some other stuff. But Scott Trappy is here, and this is really cool. This is a really, really big study that was done, and Scott Trappy is director of Ball State's Human Performance Laboratory, our laboratory, and leader of an 11-person research team. He said that we saw people that who exercise regularly year after year have better overall health. These 75-year-old men and women have similar cardiovascular health to a 40 or 45-year-old. I mean, 30 years, I guess, maybe three decades. Mr. Trappy, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
Well, good. You're in Muncie, Indiana.
Yep, beautiful here today. The sun's shining. Going to be a good day for running.
Well, when it's probably about 30, 40 degrees, you got to just run to stay warm, don't you?
Well, it depends. You generate a little heat when you run, so it's not bad. You get used to it.
Do you generate heat? I guess you do. I live in Dripping Springs, and I don't even have a heating system, and I get on my rebounder and bounce around, and it does warm you up, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Exercise definitely stokes the fire.
Stokes the fire. So tell me about this study. It's pretty cool. This was a big study, too, you all did.
Yeah, it took us about 5 years to do. We had some excellent funding from the National Institutes of Health. A little background, I've been doing aging research my whole career, which dates back when I got started in the mid-1990s, coming
really?
Out of graduate school.
Oh, good. We'll have a lot to talk about then.
Yeah, well, I grew up a swimmer, so I was always interested in sort of athlete performance. That's why I got in the business, actually. But then I kind of realized from a research perspective that doesn't pay the bills. Everybody likes it, but you got it. So I was doing some aging stuff for a number of years. We'd bring people in their 70s and 80s in the lab. We'd strength train them. We'd aerobic train them and look at how much we could improve these, their cardiovascular system and their, how we could make their muscles grow and whatnot. And we were always doing athlete research sort of in parallel to that and because of our interest. And then just kind of, merge those two. The idea just, different people I worked out with, the culture, if you go back with what I call the exercise boom or the running boom, I guess I'm just taking phrases other people have used, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, there was really a big move that happened here in our country. And, for the first time, we were beginning to see enough people age, into their 70s where we could look at this. People that have done lifelong exercise. We had studied a few athletes in the past that had fit that bill, but they were more champion athletes in their youth and kind of had, you know, a little different path in life. So we were interested in these people that were exercise was a hobby, right? I mean, they had families, they had careers, and you know, so they had to have discipline and just, you know, go through life where it was an exercise. You know, some competed and were more vigorous, and others just did it more for, you know, the health benefits, so to speak. So that was our general idea going into it. We got the funding and then started recruiting people and bringing them into the lab. And, you know, the end result was, this is one of several papers. We got more in the queue on different different systems. This is sort of the lead paper that outlines the cardiovascular and some basic premise for muscle health.
Oh, so when you do these studies, excuse me, Scott, you'll put out one paper and one study, and then you have a lot of information, then you'll put out something else sometime later, and then put out various and several different studies and papers.
Yeah, so ultimately, you know, all the data we collected over this 5 years probably will end up being around 8 papers or so.
Uh-huh.
The total amount of information. So we've got some muscle mass data. That'll be the next paper that's in the queue. From the muscle biopsy work, we got a lot more stuff we're working on related to exercise genetics. These are a little bit more complicated. They take more time to sort of figure out the data. So, you know, there's just a variety of things we're continuing to work on that'll build upon, you know, this initial paper.
So what you found out really, big picture, is that this ongoing exercise and either competitive or or just for fun, say hobby, did you see a lot of difference in those? Somebody that is really competitive or somebody just kind of fools around 3 or 4 times a week?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, let's start with the cardiovascular health. One of the key measures we look at in the lab is maximal oxygen consumption, or VO2 max, and that's really the gold standard index for cardiovascular fitness.
VO2 max, well, tell us what that is.
Well, that's maximal oxygen consumption. So what we do during that test is, when you're working, we put a person on a bike and we have them hook up to hoses to collect their expired air, so with that's coming out of their lungs. And we're measuring the oxygen content of that. And while you're exercising, your muscles are actually taking up and utilizing oxygen. And the harder you go, the more you use. And so we put them on a bike and gradually increase the load to where it's like they're cycling up the side of a mountain, essentially, to where we stress the body towards working at maximal effort. And then we're able to look at the total amount of oxygen that's being consumed during that test. And it's really an integrated measure of the heart and the lungs, the muscles, the cardiovascular system, all working together. So it's an excellent index of cardiorespiratory fitness.
So let's see if we understand. So you're putting somebody on a bike, and you can do it with the tension on the pedals as well as whatever, and you can go to a max and you see how much oxygen's getting into the muscles themselves.
Yeah. Exactly. So the bike, we have a specialized bike in the lab, but what we do is just gradually increase the resistance. So it's a kind of a ramp, like you're just gradually starting the hill, and you start to work harder and harder, and then we're measuring physiologically, we're measuring that effort and quantifying it here in the lab.
And so it's, when we let's see, if we just leisurely say rebounding, which I do, and other say leisurely rebounding or leisurely jog, or you just kind of bouncing up and down, or just kind of running, you know, not that fast, just, you know, like you see people do. What's the difference, Scott Trappi, between doing that for, say, 10 or 15 minutes with the VO2 and, say, rebounding with some weights as fast as you can, or jumping up and down, or running in place as fast as you can for 2-3 minutes?
Well,
like a burst exercise compared to 15 or 20 minutes, I guess.
Yeah, well, if you're going like kind of the first example you illustrate, you're out for a nice jog, let's say. You know, that would be, we would consider that at a submaximal level. You know, that probably for most people is going to be somewhere in the, you know, 50, 60, 70% of max effort.
Uh-huh.
you know, if you go for like jogging in place for a bit, you're going to be at a higher percentage of effort, but you're going to go for a shorter period of time.
So what does max effort mean? Does that mean really full out, a saber-toothed tiger is coming after you, and if you don't get up the tree, you're going to die? Is that max effort?
That's one form of max effort with the flight or flight system.
Right.
This test is designed in such a way to sort of look at what the maximal amount of oxygen is that you can consume. The test itself takes about 8 to 10 minutes.
Hmm.
So if you did an all-out sprint to get up the tree and save your life, as you're explaining, you may not fully maximize the cardiovascular system. You'd have a lot of other sort of what I'll call anaerobic or the getaway systems activated. So this test is specifically designed to maximize the use of the cardiovascular system.
So talk to us about what that means when you're maximizing the use of the cardiovascular system. What does that all entail?
Well, you'd be at maximal heart rate. You'd have maximal amount of air moving in and out of the lungs. You'd have a large muscle mass recruited, and they would be consuming as much oxygen as could be delivered to the working muscles.
Hmm. That's maximum. And how do we, is there a calculation to know how we can get to that? If we are at that, jogging or running or whatever, I mean, or playing tennis or something like that?
Yeah, most activities we do are all at submaximal versions of that. Now, you may end up being in a workout or race situation where near the end of the workout or the race where you could be approaching your quote-unquote VO2 max. You know, so there are ways in the field when people are exercising where you get to that. But most of the time, most exercise is done at levels below that.
So when we're getting this VO2 thing happy, working, and increasing, is it expanding the blood vessels and making them stronger, putting oxygen? Talk about what's really going on.
Yeah, well, you know, it's everything. I mean, it's the heart is actually bigger and more efficient at working and pumping blood out. The lungs is well. The vessels are more complete. Our blood volume actually goes up. The capillaries in our muscle improve to enhance blood flow and oxygen delivery to the muscles. There's a whole series of changes that happens in your muscle with exercise that allow for more efficient utilization to break down the carbohydrates and fats and provide energy during exercise. So it's like a chain link with all these things. Exercise really improves them all to where the engine or the body works more efficiently during exercise.
So is it fair to say it's kind of a built-in evolutionary kind of a cool thing that the body does when we stress it a bit, and the body, things just get stronger from blood vessels to muscles, everything. It just does it like that? It's just magic?
Well, magic's one way.
Yeah, I don't know. It's pretty cool when you think about it.
Yeah, you're right. We're trying to unwrap the magic a little bit and understand it better in the lab. But you're right. I mean, it's evolutionary to where the bodies adapt. Exercise is a stress, and bodies adapt to that. So not only do you benefit during the exercise, but then those benefits from exercise are also very beneficial in all the time we spend outside of exercise in life as well.
Oh, you mean so when we're just sitting around, we're just having an easier time just, I don't know, breathing and not getting floppy?
Resting heart rate's lower, our vessels are healthier and more compliant. There's a whole series of things that are most, more healthy because of the exercise that we benefit from around the clock.
Pretty cool. Scott Trappe, director of Ball State's Human Performance Laboratory, talking about this study they did. If you have a question, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Does the heart, when we do all this stuff, does the heart really get literally bigger?
You got it.
Really?
It does.
It gets bigger.
Yeah. It gets bigger, it gets more efficient. You know, to an extent, you know, these lifelong exercisers, one way to look at it is what the exercise is doing here is also maintaining heart health Because one of the things that happens as we get older, we tend to shrink a lot of components of the body. The heart's one of them, the skeletal muscle. They will get smaller or atrophy as we age, and the exercise will help. It doesn't completely prevent it. Some systems it does, it looks like, but it certainly slows the aging process for sure.
Do you have any idea? I don't know how geeky you guys get into the human body. Do you have any idea how this aerobic exercise affects maybe the actual strength of the big, you know, the portal, the big ones that go to the heart? What are they, about four or five kind of main guys? Do they get stronger or even bigger, allowing more blood through? Do we know?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing to look at, the way to look at this, Patrick, is that they're more compliant.
More compliant. So, 'cause what
happens, as we get older, our vessels get stiffer. And
so kind of like people who are not very active, you know, older folk, you know, 70, 80s, they just get kind of stiffen up because they sit around and everything stiffens up.
You got it. It's like a nice rubber band, a new rubber band's very compliant and stuff. You leave it lay around for several years, it's less stretchy, it's more brittle, or a garden hose or whatever. It's the same thing. Same concept, I guess.
Do you have any evidence that we've had some people on the show that suggest that they really study this stuff, that if some of these guys get, the big guys get clogged up with the plaque and cholesterol that's trying to repair something, that the body actually does ancillary capillaries around to make sure that the heart gets the blood? Do you guys see any of that? Or are you, of course, you don't cut these guys open, so you wouldn't see that, would you?
That's a little outside my lane in terms of what we do for research, but, you know, the stuff I've read, people I interact with, you know, certainly there's some, you know, additional routing that goes on, but also exercise can reverse some of these negative effects that have happened, you know, sort of with the distensibility of the vessels and the sort of, you know, quote unquote clogging. But yeah.
Did you see, with the folks that you studied that did this often, did you do numbers and do all the heart numbers with the HDL and all that stuff too, to check?
Yeah, we did actually. The thing there, so if you look at it, we had older people that were non-exercisers brought in, but we had an extensive screening process, so they had to be healthy to get in the study. So in some respects, they were elite as well. They volunteered, they were active people. They just weren't doing structured exercise. There's a whole other cohort, you know, sector like we didn't study that kind of, you know, had a fair amount of disease, which would even be lower than some of the people we studied. So even the older non-exercisers were healthy. So basic lipid profiles and stuff were relatively good in all our people. But I would say the exercisers were on fewer meds to control that. You know, most people these days, especially with the blood lipid profile, you know, the physician will just put them on a statin. And those things, you know, those things are pretty effective. So we didn't exclude for that in our study. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to test anybody.
Well, a lot of folks were on statins, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's really, it's a lot.
Especially in that age range. But, you know, they're introducing them into, you know, people's lives much earlier these days, too. So.
Yeah, an emailer wants to know, George, is there a way that we can test our own VO2 max ourselves at home?
You know, no, not really, not specifically. That is a kind of a specific test we do in the lab. A lot of these fitness watches and stuff these days, we have a Garmin watch, or I think Apple does it as well, and I don't know if Fitbit does, but they have, you know, VO2 max estimators in there if you're wearing these during exercise. And it'll give you some feedback. You know, to be honest, I got those watches, I wear them, and I know what my VO2 max is because I measure it quite frequently. Like one, I test myself at least once every year. And, you know, those watch estimators are actually pretty good. It's without having all the expensive equipment and access to a lab, it does put you in the right zip code in terms of what your VO2 max would be.
So in this 5-year study, tell us about how often and how hard that these, and the groups that you had, and kind of walk through that a little bit. We'd like to understand the difference.
Yeah, okay. So we ended up with more men than women. We really were hoping to get both, and we did. And we think some of that was the cultural sort of phenomenon. Men were ahead of the women coming into the game. Title IX helped change all that. So as a result of having more men, the men, we had two groups. We had a lifelong exercise group that we referred to as performance-oriented. So they were training a little bit more vigorously because they were still signing up and competing for events. And then we had a fitness group we called fitness, that they weren't exercising quite as vigorously, but the frequency and time that they were putting in was the same as the performance guys. They just weren't going at it quite as hard. So they exercised 4 to 5 for the last 52 years on average. Our folks, men and women, had exercised about 5 days a week, about 7 hours per week.
Say that again. That's a lot, right? Let's see. It seems like
it's a lot. It is pretty decent, to be honest with you. It's good. What was interesting, too, is, you know, these people were 4 to 5 days, you know, per week. And as they got sort of a little bit older, as their families and kids moved on, their exercise actually began to ratchet back up a little bit. And you saw another sort of increase as their careers wind down and they retired. And exercise has always just been a hobby. So when they had more time, they tended to fill that void with less family and less career with exercise. So instead of decreasing their exercise as they got older, they tended to stabilize it or actually increase it a little bit.
So if we talk about something, Scott Trappi, like, oh, I need to do a quick little break here. Can you hold on?
Sure.
Yeah, let me do a quick break. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. If you have a question about this, here's a real exercise geek. They've been in the studying people and putting wires on them and might learn something about how to just leverage your exercise program a little bit more. That's the whole idea. Next hour, we'll talk a little bit about some of the things going on in the world today with these different epidemics and where they come from and stuff like that. Some pretty... Dr. Jane Orient, we're going to talk to her. 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Well, if you want to get one of these rebounders, we have them for, I think they're, I don't even know what the cost is anymore. They're $319, something like that. It's a good value. These are the Rebound Air rebounders. And why not get yourself one now and have this baby in before Christmas and then you can start the new year. You know, it's always fun. At $339, this is the classic half-fold. There's a lifetime warranty on these guys. They're really well-built. They have about 48, I think, jumbo springs. Lifetime warranty on everything. All you got to do is call up, even if a spring breaks. Not to be confused with spring breaks in Florida with the college students, but spring breaks. And they're really, they're fun. What's nice about them, I've been rebounding for, I don't know, 25, 30 years now. You can do a lot of different stuff on them. Like we're talking about, you can do the burst exercise thing, which I like to do, where you can just run as fast as you can for 30 seconds or a minute or so, and I can get my heart rate about triple what it, my resting, my 60 to 180. I'm going to ask, we'll talk a lot to Scott, too, about heart rate and all that kind of stuff too before we wrap up our conversation with them. But you can get your heart going really good like that. Or you can just kind of do 10, 15 minutes. Another way these are really fun is I have a little timer thing, I know, some kind of a app called Iris, and you can set it for once an hour and it just goes off when I'm here in the studio answering emails and stuff every hour. And then I'll get up and then rebound for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. You can set that for as long as you want. And then you can rebound for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes in your office and then get back. And it's just not good to keep sitting all the time. So I like to play around with that. I don't do it every hour. Sometimes I just say, I'm going to skip, as humans do. But these are cool. Just click on the rebound ad, $339 delivered in the lower 48 states. $339 delivered, and we get it to you probably in 4 or 5 days from the time you order. And if you want to get it by Christmas, you want to just get it in now and you can hide it in the garage so Santa Claus can bring it to somebody. and it's on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com, the Rebound Air Lifetime Warranty. Previously, with a longtime friend, Phil Wilson, the exclusive distributor of the Relax Far Infrared Sauna.
I've been sweating and promoting the benefits of saunas and sweating for 16 years now. Can you believe it?
Wow, 16 years. Regularly that long?
20 minutes a day for about 15 years now.
6 months ago, man, I started doing it every day, and I don't think I've missed a day. How this has improved my life, I mean, I can't tell you. It's pretty amazing. I tell you what, I feel better and better. What's going on?
Well, the proof is definitely in the pudding. And if a person would go to YouTube and search for Relax Sauna testimonials, they'll get 650 testimonies on what the Relax Sauna has done for different individuals, from feeling better to getting rid of extreme pain to getting rid of neuropathy to just helping a person feel more calm, alert, relaxed, tuned in, and everything else.
And everything else. These are really lovely units, extremely low EMFs. Email me, Patrick, at OneRadioNetwork.com, and I'll give you a deal on this sauna. We also have an option to get a relaxed heat lamp, but we'll work it out together. Email me, Patrick, at OneRadioNetwork.com. That spot was recorded with Phil, I think, 2 years ago. So it's been probably 2.5 years when I really took the whole sauna thing to another level. You know, I had it there and I'd use it, you know, three times. And after talking to Phil, well, before that, I just somehow just kicked in and boom. And I do it every day now. Just, I don't miss a day. They're really beneficial. Get rid of a lot of junky stuff in your fat. And Dr. Rhonda Patrick talks about the heat shock proteins in your heart. We're talking to Scott Trappi about that. Really good for your heart. Really good to strengthen blood vessels and things like this. Sauna, they're cool. Email me and I'll hook you up, Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously with chemist, biologist, and nutritionist George Altgelt, we asked him this. And so what do you think about Dr. Seneff's contention that as these glyphosates are in the soil, they bust the sulfur cycle, and that's really detrimental to the body?
It's extremely detrimental. Sulfur is such an important detoxifying agent for the entire body and especially for the liver. You've got to have trace minerals so that the liver can build these compounds that are essential for getting itself cleaned. And that lady who was talking about sulfur, man, play that ad every chance you get, because our foods are so deficient in sulfur, and it is a big deal for the liver to have enough sulfur to make all those compounds that it uses to detoxify itself. Not just sulfur, they're all important, but sulfur is the one that we're so deficient in, and we need sulfur.
Thanks, George. I had some this morning. You might want to give it a try. You can click an order right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. 3 locations, 3 prices, delivered. And if you like more than £4 for a discount, email me, Patrick, at OneRadioNetwork.com. There's a terrific amount of evidence that can, scientifically, that sulfur brings oxygen to a lot of different places in the body more easily. And we're talking about oxygen with Scott Trappi. And now you just need the water, too. Without the water, it doesn't work. So you got to drink more water. The general recommendation is 1 teaspoon twice a day, maybe at 150 pounds. And then if you weigh 200 or so, you can increase that. And you can do more as well. The only downside is people that have never taken it before, they oftentimes feel a little yucky for a few days because they detoxify. And the trick there is just do more and it'll go away real quick. And these sulfur has a love affair with heavy metals. And you can just click an order right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com.
Know the source on One Radio Network.
Okay, we're having fun talking to Scott Trappi. He is director of Ball State's Human Performance Laboratory, leader of 11-person team. So even before this study, Scott Trappi, you've been really interested in this whole longevity thing?
Oh, yeah. Aren't we all?
Yeah, why not? I mean, I think it's fun just to figure out how to take these bodies out for a spin and see what they'll do, you know?
Yeah, I agree. You know, we're trying. I think at the end of the day, we know exercise is good for you.
Sure. Sure.
We're trying to quantify, you know, kind of get under the hood and quantify what some of these benefits really are.
Yeah.
And, you know, the results we're finding actually are quite striking.
I'm really curious. So you mentioned 5 days a week, 7 hours, say an hour every, whatever, an hour, 15 minutes, whatever that turns out to. Do we have any idea, Scott, if you were like rebounding or let's say jogging, if you did like half of that, would the benefits decrease by half? Do we know?
Well, we have a general feel for that. I think at the end of the day, we know all forms of exercise are beneficial. You could be walking. Anything's better than being a couch potato in terms of being active.
Sure.
Walking.
Sure.
Quite a bit of benefits, and as you ratchet up the intensity, you do or duration, you do tend to gain benefits for that. There is sort of a plateau that tends to happen, and it depends on the system. Like as an example, in our study, the performance individuals, you know, had a cardiovascular system that was about 30 years younger. So their cardiovascular system looked like 40, 45-year-olds. The fitness people, their cardiovascular system was more like 55, 60-year-olds. So they took off 15, 20 years. So you can see there was some difference, you know, where there were benefits to the size of the cardiovascular fitness or for the performance individuals.
So the folks that are really, excuse me, go ahead.
I was just going to say, when we looked at the muscles, we have a special procedure we do in the lab where we take a muscle biopsy. We get a sample about the size of a pea, and we can do all sorts of things with it. And two key things we did for this part of the study was we looked at the number of capillaries that were inside the muscle. So that gives us these microvessels that allow blood flow and transports oxygen and substrate, you know, fuels and carbohydrates and fats and all sorts of things around the body and through the muscle itself. So we looked at these capillaries, and then we looked at these aerobic enzymes that process fuels during exercise. And our old people's data, performance and fitness, were the same. And both of those groups were the same as the young exercisers. So it looked like there was really, if I showed you the data, you or your listeners, you wouldn't be able to tell me which group was the old group and which group was the young group.
So the body doesn't care if it's been, you know, 70 revolutions around the sun or 40 if you're doing the same stuff. It reacts the same way.
Well, it depends. You know, there are other parts of the body where, you know, we get older, our eyes aren't as good, we don't hear as well, certain things. But, the exercise, certain components, it looks like it's, you know, it's helping, and certain components it's helping, you know, almost where you can't even tell that any aging had occurred.
Pretty cool. So when we build muscle, Scott Trappi, are we actually putting more of these little capillaries in there?
Well, it depends on what form you're doing. With exercise, with aerobic exercise, the answer to that is yes. And as we decrease our physical activity and become more sedentary, we actually take some away. So this is sort of an expandable pool. It can increase if your activity increases, and it can decrease if your activity decreases.
And does the increase in the capillaries depend on intensity as well as time?
That one, the verdict's out on that. It appears there's a bit of a threshold. If you get around 4 days a week in, and at least if you're moderate in type of intensity or above, that sort of seems to be the sort of plateau or, you know, breaking point. That may kind of, I think over time as we get more data, that we'll get more clarity on that. But, a modest amount of activity and intensity seems to more or less preserve that system.
Mm-hmm. What can you, this may be outside your pay grade, and if it is, let me know, but do you have any insights on fuel to do this, carbohydrates, proteins, stuff like that? Do you guys look at that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I grew up doing that stuff in terms of my early training. We still do it in the lab stuff today. So, you know, when people exercise, the primary fuel sources are carbohydrate and fat. And as we exercise, the blend of those fuels during exercise will be modified. Typically, as the exercise duration increases, we slowly become more fat burners than carbohydrate burners if we're kind of at this submaximal pace. So the carbohydrate-fat mixture will be dependent upon intensity, and it'll also be dependent upon duration.
So what are the key elements to build muscle?
If you want to build muscle...
Fuel. Let's do fuel and then exercise. Let's do fuel first.
One of the things that is, I guess it's an epidemic in our country with the obesity research, or, you know, the level of obesity. And what happens there is the fuel substrates change. The muscle becomes insensitive, if you will, to glucose or carbohydrates. The composition inside the muscle is greatly altered. And it's pretty clear exercise can reverse that effect. So the more fit you are, the more your fuel substrate selection looks like that of a young exerciser.
Oh, so you're talking about the insulin resistance when people do so much it's carbs, carby, 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 and then it just screws things up with the insulin resistance.
Well, I think that's carby, carby, carby with no exercise.
With no exercise.
As long as you're an active individual and eat a mixed diet, you're fine.
So do we need carbs to build muscle, put on weight?
Yeah, carbs are an important part of the diet plan. I think, you know, I think a lot of the diet fads and stuff, my bias out there, I'm getting out, you're getting more here into my opinion versus my data.
No, that's
data.
All right. Go ahead. You're into it, so your opinion matters.
Well, I think at the end of the day, a lot of these diets are fads and stuff, and, they're short-lived benefits, whereas... You know, a good mixed diet of the right amount of calories is the long-term ticket. Balance that with good exercise, and you've got a recipe that is really the elixir.
Well, that's kind of fun. I think we're seeing more and more of that, Scott, with all the people we talk to day in and day out. It's coming around almost full circle. I don't know. It's really strange. I've been studying this stuff for 30 years, not as long as you, but it's almost like little bit of everything just so it's good quality seems like a really nice diet.
Well, I think you're right.
Yeah.
But that doesn't sell books and videos.
Oh,
all
of
the
course. Yeah.
Along
yeah.
With it, so.
That's right. You can't sell books with that. just eat a little bit of everything, be an omnivore, and you're fine, right? So yeah. I'm curious, though. I mean, I see some of these paleo dudes, and they're just eating meat and vegetables. And the ones I see, of course, they're younger. I mean, they're just kids, you know, they're 30, 40. So I don't know. Do you think you could do just the meat and vegetable thing like long forever?
Well, our bodies are set up to process it. You know, there's, you know, people that would disagree with when you look at some of these diets, but there haven't been like super awesome controlled experiments.
Sure.
They have a little bias associated with them, and they're oftentimes not long term, so we don't know what the long-term like implication with the lipid profile and stuff would be. But again, not doing anything too extreme seems to be, you know, a wise move combined with exercise for long-term health versus going one extreme or the other.
You may have heard me talking about on my rebounder, you know, the pulse rate. Now, I can remember the gym fix days back, what was that, in the 70s or 80s, right? The runner and this whole idea, Scott Trappi, what was that formula? Oh, 220 minus your age, and then you did 75% of that, and that would be a pulse rate that you'd want to keep for so long to do good things for your body. Is that relevant?
Yeah, it is. That description you're providing there definitely provides a formula for a sound exercise bout, you know, assuming people have been cleared by their physician and healthy, you know, to do it. That's right in the, you know, sort of sweet spot for maximal adaptations to the aerobic system.
Mm-hmm. Is there any value in going over that?
Depends on what your goals are. I think certainly for performance reasons to go compete, yes. For, just health benefits, you know, going over that, you could, you know, do it to feel good or whatever. I don't think you're sort of getting to the point of, from a health perspective, maybe there aren't huge benefits in return. I think there are a few things that we could drill down on related to that as you do increase some intensity. If you did a few, I'll call them intervals, to extend beyond that, there are some benefits for muscle where you're going to recruit these high threshold motor units or the fast muscle fibers and help keep them healthy and stuff. So I think there are some general benefits to do that, but I don't think, I would shy away from you know, there's been a lot of talk in the media about the HIIT training, which I think I think there's some benefits to that. But, you know, a good steady diet of overall good balanced exercise with some complementary HIIT training probably is a bit more of a good long-term recipe versus, you know, you see some of this, the sellers that, you know, I can just do 4 minutes of exercise and I'm going to get all these benefits. And, you know, again, that, you know, that's a snake oil salesman.
You know, so a lot of the burst people and the HIIT people, HIIT training, they're kind of promoting the idea that if you go really, really hard on, you know, boom, 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 4 minutes or 5 minutes, that it's just like doing it for 15 and 20. Is there any science to prove that?
Yeah, there's some nice science out there. A couple, you know, a handful of studies were done by Marty Gabala and his group up in Canada showing some, you know, really nice aerobic benefits from that. You know, I would say you got to counter that too with the risk, because there are, you know, the joint forces and different things that happen. Their chance for injury, in my view, increase when you get into that zip code of exercise as well. So, you know, there's a variety of things you have to really kind of put into the basket to chew on before you make a final selection. But I think some form of HIIT training incorporated into your general exercise routine is fine. But I think it shouldn't be the only form that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email for you. Has Scott's research quantified any of the effects of some nutrients that have on promoted, that are being promoted for improved exercise, like B12 to quickly generate oxygen-carrying red blood cells for muscle strength and endurance, carnosine to buffer hydrogen ions, making muscle tissue less acidic, delaying fatigue, and amino acids after a workout to quickly rebuild muscles. It'd be interesting to see if there's any real research that's showing these nutrients do what they claim they'll do.
Now, I can say I have specifically not. I know a few people that are. I think we're at times chasing the latest and greatest with some of these things. You know, most people are exercising, you know, one time per day. And, you know, again, we're back to sort of a steady diet, a mixed diet and good exercise. And that more or less takes care of it. Now, if you are concerned with growing muscles, particularly with aging, if we are concerned about performing where we're exercising more than one time per day, kind of coming back from an exercise bout, the science data is very sound on sort of what I'll call windows of opportunities to feed. And that is after the exercise bout, the muscle sort of acts as a bit of a sponge for up to 4 hours. So if you feed the body after exercise, you do tend to have some synergistic benefits that go along with the exercise and the nutrition. And I don't think the nutrition has to be necessarily a magic bullet, but it's certainly of good quality. And you do tend to see some benefits from that.
So there is something to these YouTube videos with these dudes. They work out and then they drink this huge whatever they make, you know, this big protein thing with all this stuff in there an hour or two after. So there is something to it where the muscles actually eat the food more readily or get to the food somehow.
Yeah, as we sit here, like I'm just sitting at my desk now talking with you, we sort of have, I have a number of doorways that are in my, sort of open in my muscle, if you will, to bring in various nutrients and stuff. But if I go to exercise, the demand goes up, so the number of these sort of doorways increases, so the overall flux of, you know, nutrients into the muscle can increase, and those doorways then are open post-exercise. So you combine that with feeding, and it's an opportunity to sort of, you know, take advantage of that window and feed the muscle.
Uh-huh. And again, do we know the best stuff to feed that muscle if you want to really max and leverage that exercise you just spent 45 minutes doing, lifting weights or whatever?
Sorry.
That's all right.
No, I think, again, you're going to get a wide range of opinions on that. I think for most of our common listeners, we're really dealing with just, you know, some post-exercise nutrition that's, you know, just balanced diet.
Wow. Okay, cool. On the phone, good morning.
I don't really think it has to be anything too exotic.
Okay. Who's this on the phone? Good morning.
Oh, good morning. This is Julie from California.
Hi, Julie. You're on the air with Scott Trappi. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about running and training for marathons. Do you feel that that's, like, detrimental to your health? The
running
amount of stress it puts on your kidneys and everything?
Do I think running marathons detrimental to your health? Is that your question?
Yes.
I'd say no. Depends, actually. I think running marathons is fine. It can be healthy, especially when you're younger. Even when you're older.
I will say
over time, the cardiovascular system and the muscle system holds up very well with that. But we do see orthopedic issues with, you know, years and years of running on the frame, to where that could start over time to become detrimental because of the orthopedic issues. And in fact, most of the people we had in our study started off because of the running boom, and over time, their knees or hips or whatever, they'd switch modes of exercise into cycling or something that was a little bit more joint friendly.
Yeah. So, Julie, how old are you? You were asking it like in your age. What'd you say your age was?
61.
And has she run marathons before?
Never.
Well, what's the longest event you've done?
I'm actually asking about my husband.
I see.
He's recently gotten hooked on running.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's almost like an obsession, you know, because he gets that runner's high.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he just ran his first marathon. And anyway, they had a kind of a thing on some TV station about what actually happens to your body when you run a marathon, about how you go into a state of dehydration and your kidneys actually stop working.
Well, first of all, I would say congratulations to your husband. That's great to hear. And if he doesn't have a lot of previous running, my guess is his frame's probably in pretty good shape. As long as you're kind of following the general rules, I don't see any major risks. Now, you know, the dehydration component is a risk during a marathon, especially if it's really hot out. But that can be mitigated by properly drinking during the marathon, or, you know, avoiding really hot marathons altogether, which maybe is a general approach, you know, so you're not quite as miserable. There is a recovery phase after the marathon, you know, to take into account, but I've got friends that are, you know, into their 80s and still running. So, you know, I think as long as you've kind of following the general rules and listening to your body, the rewards outweigh the risks.
Okay.
Thanks,
okay.
Julie. So do you think these runners had really had given their knees a hard time and all that? Do you think it was, Scott, because of the surface? And if they would have been able to run on just soil or land, it'd be a lot different?
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, if they would have been trail runners, they might have been able to extend their running career. If we would have had maybe a bit more of the shoe, softer shoe technology, mm-hmm. you know, they kind of running on boards on asphalt and concrete back, you know, all those years. And, you know, over time, the you know, the joints just broke down.
Yeah, that's why I've been a big fan of, you've heard me probably on the Rebounder. It absorbs about 85% of the impact on your joints. You know, it's pretty cool. Yeah, and you can... You know, you can get right up there and get that pulse rate going.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's all sorts of ways to do this. I think, A, you need to find something you enjoy, like the last caller fell in love with running. You know, it could be any mode of exercise that works, and maybe in people's cases it needs to be joint friendly. It could be a different mode. Could be this piece of equipment you're talking about. Could be swimming. Could be cycling. Weightlifting is part of the should be part of the program. You know, I think there's just so many different journeys that people can take to, you know, to benefit from this. It's not necessarily a one size fits all.
Sure. Any opinions? This has been going back and forth for years too on the idea when you're talking about resistance training of doing really heavy stuff at lower reps or lighter and doing more reps. Do you have any? You've been studying this for a long time. Any opinions on that, or science, either one?
Well, I do. I have, like anybody else, I have opinions. But the science is supportive. You know, most of the science for, let's say, as we age, is that the type of resistance training that you would need does not need to be that exotic. The type of things we've done here in the laboratory is do like a classic 3 sets of 10, at 70% of your max 3 times per week, and we can get the muscles to grow 6-7%, which is pretty substantial.
Okay, well, let's walk through that a second. That's cool. So us non-white people, I'm just starting to play around with it myself again after, you know, not doing it for 5 years. Okay, 3 sets of 10. So say you have, how would that work? So say you had a 20-pound weight and you were just doing curls or something like that. Walk us through that.
Well, one of the keys to get the muscle to grow, it has to be of reasonable intensity. So the data suggests you need to be about 60 to 70% of your best effort to sort of maximally flip on all the triggers that tell the muscle to grow.
Of your best effort. Would that be like, how do we know what that best effort is? In other words, just lifting it, curling it one time and just giving it everything?
Let's just say for discussion's sake, you could curl 100 pounds one time.
Okay, all right.
And then so you would need to do these 3 sets of 10 at 60 or 70 pounds.
Oh, so you would do 60 or 70 pounds, 10 curls, and then you rest and then do it again?
Take 2 minutes rest, do it again, 2 minutes rest, do it again. Uh-huh. Just kind of straightforward mashed potatoes and gravy.
Yeah.
Most everybody could get their mind around it and implement it. And, you know, with that approach, we see excellent results.
How many times a week?
We've implemented 3. I personally think you can go down to as little as 2. It depends on what your goal is. You know, do you want to grow your muscles? Do you want to just hang on to what you've got and preserve your muscles? Those are a little different approaches. We did a study a handful of years ago where we took a group, we trained them for 3 months. We got their muscles. These were older gentlemen in their 70s. We got their muscles to grow about 7%.
Wow.
And then we took a half the group, quit training. After that, they were traveling south for the winter. And the other half, we just brought back in 1 day per week and did this 3 sets of 10. So, it took them 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And the group that 6 months later, the group that had quit training reverted back to their pre-training status. And the group that came in and did this just once a week, they did not improve further from their post-training values, but they didn't lose any either.
Wow, that's interesting, isn't it?
1 day a week, 20 minutes, they were able to hang on to all the benefits they gained from the training program.
To keep the 7% they gained.
You got it.
And well, that's pretty interesting. At 70 years old.
You got it.
I'll be darned. I mean,
yeah.
Would that number be different if you're 20 revolutions around the sun, a kid, 20 years old?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. youth's on your side there in terms of, you're really not. The difference between the 70, 80-year-old and the 20-year-old is the 70, 80-year-old is in sort of a muscle loss phase of life, and whereas the 20-year-old is not. So
right.
I suspect there probably would be some differences with the very young people.
So in other words, if somebody wanted to do this, you could just pick out which muscle groups you wanted to work on. So would you do 4 or 5 of these 3 sets of 10 if you were doing like shoulders or pull-ups or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. I got a little circuit I run through here at the lab that I do that with. It takes me about 35 minutes.
Uh-huh. And then you do that maybe 3 times a week?
Yeah, well, two or three. I think is the sweet spot for everybody to manage. And I think the difference between 2 and 3 is probably negligible. I don't have the data to support that. It's kind of a gut feeling from all the stuff we've done.
Boy, even 2 times a week, even couch potatoes could do that, right?
Well, I'd hope so.
even the couchies, man, they can do that. Well, it's pretty fun. Let's see. Wouldn't we miss anything here? What else? The VO2 max. Anything else on the top of your mind as far as this study that just came out that would be interesting to our listeners that I didn't ask you about? Let's see. Can you think of anything?
I think we covered a lot of ground. You know, at the end of the day, kind of exercise wins. Just really substantial benefits with these lifelong exercisers. So it's great to be able to start to quantify this.
Sure.
And I appreciate you promoting the message to get this out.
Oh, yeah.
To people,
it's fun.
You know, begin to understand what's going on with our bodies and that exercise really is, you know, the elixir to do our best to slow the aging process.
Lisa says, I like to walk. This is a good question. I'm glad she brought it up. Just came in my inbox. I like to walk 30 to 45 minutes or an hour every morning, but I just do just walk. Is this doing my body? Is this doing me any good other than my mental health?
No. Walking is an excellent form of exercise, and there is a substantial amount of health benefits that go along with that.
Is there any upside to carrying weights or put the weight on their ankles or walking faster? I guess there would be if you wanted to do that.
I think a brisk walk, the more you probably help a bit. I tend to get a little cautious with the weights with walking.
Yeah.
I don't have any data on this, but just, it seems to me the joint forces and stuff go up. And if you're a little bit older, you already kind of want to be taking care of your knees and stuff. So I'm not really sure that would be the best strategic move to start incorporating, ankle weights or things like that may change the force dynamics during the walk. I'd probably tend to incorporate the weights separately after the walk.
Email just in from Johnny says, if my muscles are sore a couple of days after exercising, should I wait or just go ahead and exercise again? That's a good question.
Yeah, there's no downside to exercising again. I would say if the muscles are sore, a light form of exercise, not going full out, but doing a lighter version, actually can be therapeutic and help with the recovery process.
Mm-hmm. Well, there must be something pretty magical about ongoing resistance training. I know a few people personally even there, and I've seen some ladies 70 and 80 they lift weights, and we talked to one on the show, and we know another fellow. He's probably 70 or so revolutions, even more. And his face looks like he's about 40. How do you explain do you have any ideas on why that is? That people just look younger when they do resistance training as well?
Not really. I guess there's a whole, probably relates to the overall immune health boost, yeah. Systemic health and things that go that, the skin's our largest organ. And so there's probably a lot of things going on with the exercise that interfaces with skin health. We don't study that, but I certainly could understand that where those benefits might come from.
Yeah. Well, Scott, you're a friend to talk to. I appreciate it. Scott Trappi, Ball State University. He's the head of the exercise program up there. And thanks for being on the show. We learned a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Patrick. Great to join your show today.
Thank you. All right, Scott Trappi, we're going to do a little bit of thing for a little while about the flu pandemics and epidemics and stuff like that. And did you know that this is the 100th anniversary of the great influenza pandemic of 1918? Jane Orient writes that John Barry described it as the deadliest plague in history. It killed more people in a year than the Black Death in the Middle Ages. And where do these things come from? And can we get another one? And we're going to say hi to Dr. Orient after we just start the show. So stay right there, Doc.